Calling home on RNZ National Sunday morning, 28 minutes past 8. I think my cousin Tony Brooke, who lives in London where he's resided for many years with his family, would be ideal to interview. Tony is a former New Zealand rower with the New Zealand Rowing 8. The team won gold in Switzerland in the 1980s. They were the world champions and they jointly received the Sportsman of the Year award in 82 and were inducted into the New Zealand Sports Hall of Fame. Tony has had interesting endeavours and adventures over the years and your audience will enjoy his insights. Thank you, Pauline. This is also timely because although Sale GP off Littleton and the Melbourne Grand Prix are hogging the sports headlines, Warriors beating Canberra, etc., it's been the week of the Māori Cup on Lake Ruatanifa, perhaps the biggest schools rowing event in the world, a tremendous occasion really. And Tony Brooke is a man who's done an awful lot for New Zealand rowing, and that began on Otago Harbour when he was at St Paul's in Dunedin. Tony, kia ora from back home.
Well, kia ora to you, Jim, and thanks very much for having me on your show.
It's a pleasure. Where is home, actually, in your head?
Well, that's quite a poignant sort of point at the moment because lots of discussions going on about that. Home is where my heart is, and that's New Zealand. There's no doubt about that.
Right.
But physically, home's been London for the last, I don't know, 36, 37 years.
Longer than you lived in New Zealand.
I know, isn't it scary? But we've travelled back quite a bit, so, you know, I feel I've always kept a good link to lots of friends in New Zealand.
Yeah, I'm sure. Why did you disappear to the UK and what has kept you there, Tony? Is it one thing after another, the usual story?
Yeah, I was a bit of a traveller and there's some opportunities to work over here and I took those and really, and then I met someone and... that's my wife now, and so I thought it was just for a couple of years, Jim, but it sort of didn't work out like that. I've been here for a lot longer, but as I say, I've been able to travel back. We've all traveled back quite a bit to keep in touch with people.
Your wife Sarah has a pretty important job, doesn't she?
Yeah, she does. She's a clinical psychologist and director of the National Autistic team here in London and has a couple of groups under her control, and they diagnose kids and young adults and with autism and put a program in place for them and their parents and whatever. She's been doing it for a long time and she's very good at it.
I'm sure she is. That's pretty substantial work. And you've got children, Ben, Amelia and William. How do they feel about New Zealand?
Well, I mean, they've all been there, and I took them all out individually and when they were younger, and they really like it. They like New Zealand. They like the people in the countryside. My sons were there during COVID. And when they could, they jumped on motorbikes and travelled all over New Zealand and never stayed in a hotel at all, though, either with friends or family. And, they really loved it. They enjoyed it. Yeah.
What were you actually qualified to do? We know you were a great rower, but when you hit the UK in the old days, I mean, what were your qualifications?
Teaching was the first job I had when I got here. And, So I taught in New Zealand at primary school initially, and then my latest job, just as I left, I was teaching at Marlborough Boys College in Blenheim.
Yeah.
Technology. And so when I got here, I went into teaching technology in some of the private schools over here, and the rowing background was helpful, Jim, because I got some rowing master jobs to go with that. So, teaching was my main thing, but in later years I moved into construction because I've had a background in that. My dad and I built houses together, and I ended up as a project manager in construction for the last 20 years over here.
Yeah, you're fairly multi-talented. So when we started the chat, you said something. Are you having coming back home thoughts? Have you and Sarah been talking about whether you'll keep living where you're living?
Yeah, we, I mean, we, it's a topic that comes up quite often, and but recently we're giving it some serious thought. I mean, I think a lot of Kiwis overseas are doing that at the moment, Jim. I've got quite a few friends here, and they all wonder, just, you know, I mean, there's a few challenges for all of us, isn't there? Wherever you live in the world, and particularly over here, I think. And so, yeah, we're just look, I mean, we love both places. It's great. We've got a, you know, maybe we have a sort of bolt hole in both for a little while, and then make a decision a bit further down the line. That might be the way we go.
Yeah, nice if you can do that. Kingston upon Thames is where the ancient Saxon kings were crowned, if you watch the odd historical drama. I suppose you know all about that.
Yeah, you've done your homework, Jim. You're right. And yeah, it is. It was a great centre in the early history of the UK. And Hampton Court's just up the road from where we are. So yeah, it is. And the River Thames just flows by a couple hundred metres from where I live. So it's, and you know, we've got parks, Richmond Park. I mean, I always take people into Richmond Park when they come over here because it's just massive. It's about 3,500 acres right in the middle of London, and there's 600 deer running around in there, and it's just amazing when you know. In fact, those deer in there, the red deer in New Zealand, were liberated in the 30s from Richmond Park. So it's got, there's a lot of history right on their doorstep. Yeah.
Do you also take people to Hampton Court? Didn't Henry VIII live at Hampton Court?
Yeah, he used to show off a bit, Jim, and it was quite a splendid palace. And I think he used to, well, his entourage, probably about 600 or 800 people, used to do 1,500 meals a day, as he entertained everybody from Europe, and tried to
Gee.
show how powerful and splendid he was. Yeah. But
50.
I mean, it's a lovely palace, and if you came, I'd take you there, Jim. It's worth a visit.
Is
Yeah.
it? So it's maintained, it's the former splendor is still evident.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. No, they've done a terrific job in maintaining it. They look after it really well, and they tell you a wonderful story when you visit. Just, you get a real sense of the history of the place. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And the tapestries that are there are just one off. I mean, they're priceless. You know, they were made, you know, during his time, and they're just there's so much to see. You get a real sense of the what it would have been like to live there in its pomp.
Yeah, that's nice. 1,500 meals a day. Gee.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. When he was entertaining, yeah.
Imagine running the kitchen. Out of interest, how far out of town are you? You know, this is a New Zealand type question. How long to get to Buckingham Palace or, you know, Trafalgar Square, etc.?
Oh, about 20 minutes on the train. Yeah, it's well served by buses and trains, and so yeah, about 20 minutes from Buckingham Palace, from my front door in Kingston. Yep, yeah, so pretty close. Yeah,
You
yeah,
are close. Now,
yeah.
the rowing for you began at school in Dunedin, yeah?
I did. Yeah. I grew up in Dunedin and started at St Paul's when I was about 15 on Otago Harbour. Amazing. Wonderful stretch of water. Yeah.
That is.
Yeah.
You were world champions. You beat the Soviet Union and East Germany to take the world title. Do we suppose they were performance enhanced in those days? Was that a conversation you had back then?
We, no doubt about it. They were drugged to the eyeballs. Yeah, no, they seriously were. And that was in the early 80s, and yeah, the East Germans and the Russians were, and it's well documented. A lot of the UK guys I've got to know, and they were around at the time competing as well, and some of them are really quite bitter about it all because they were constantly beaten by the Eastern countries,
Yeah.
and you know, they didn't get their gold medal, as it were, and so, you know, there's quite a few people are a bit bitter about it. And in fact, I think the IOC's looking at the International Olympic Committee, perhaps looking at those results from those times and maybe doing something about it. But
Oh, that's interesting.
I think it's a bit late in the day now. But yeah.
I can imagine it would stay sour forever. There'd be a bitter taste forever, you know.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
When it
Yeah.
came to the Olympics, though, Again, what bad luck for so many athletes, including you, Tony.
Oh, yeah, that was a real disappointment. 1980, eh? And the Russians, were in Afghanistan, and President Jimmy Carter decided to call for a Western boycott, and a lot of Western countries stayed away, but a lot went. That was the thing.
Yeah.
And it was really quite tricky at the time.
When did you find out you weren't going?
Well, it was on and off, and then we were told we were going, so we trained right up, and we were on, you believe this is true, we were on the plane in Auckland ready to fly out to compete in Europe and then go on to Moscow. And the president of the New Zealand Federation, Rowing Federation, got on and said, "Chaps, we've got a bit of bad news and some good news. Bad news, you're not going to Moscow, but good news, you're going to compete in Europe." And then he ran off the plane quite quickly. And, can you imagine that?
You got to Europe and competed. You almost went to Moscow anyway, some of you, yeah, or thought about it at least.
Yeah, there was some skullduggery going on there. There was, you can imagine, the equestrian guys and the canoeists were from New Zealand were there. They were in Moscow. And when we were competing in Europe, the Russians were quite visible, talking to athletes and coaches, not so much management. It was sort of a bit under the radar, but they were obviously wanted Western crews to go to Moscow. And in Lucerne, they were talking to us, and we were pretty keen, and it was only 6 weeks away, and so they said, if you come, we'll give you boats and accommodation and we'll fly you there. And there was some New Zealand crews that were keen to go, and we were starting to make preparations, and then word got out to our management, and we were brought into a room and told if we tried something like that, we'd be in big trouble. So we kind of, it never happened, but it was pretty close, Jim. We almost got on that plane, I tell you.
Is there a part of you that wishes you'd said, "Damn it, let's go"? I mean, you couldn't have, obviously. You couldn't have. But when you look at world history since and assess that boycott, do you think it was somewhat?
No, I seriously do. I mean, in the Olympics after it, it was a tit for tat, wasn't it? So there was another boycott. So there's two Olympic cycles were up, were sort of upset by that. And we should have gone. We should have gone.
So to cut the longer story short, Tony Brooker's with us calling home from Kingston-upon-Thames. You taught at some nice schools, as you say. You wrote to us, because we had a tiny bit of correspondence in advance of our chat, and you wrote to us about how to treat young people in sport and how having no fear of failure is important. Can you expand on that philosophy a little bit?
The winning is not the thing. It's... I think it's just doing the best that they can at that point in time in a race. And that's winning. That is, if they go out there and they perform as good as they can and they enjoy it, that is winning the race. Because you don't win many races in your career. And, they develop. And if you take that sort of approach, it takes a while for them to get the idea, but then it reduces the fear. And they honestly go out and they race really well without being all anxious and uptight about it. So I've found that works really well. If you want to keep people in the sport, and because the retention rate is not great in a lot of these sports, I think they get pushed so hard when they're at school that when they leave, they kind of want to get away from it for a while. So if they've had a good experience, they'll hang about and they'll stay with it. That's what I think anyway.
And you helped out young Kiwis who came across to your school's boathouse on the Thames. So a boathouse on the Thames is something fairly special, I imagine. And Cambridge University used your boathouse or the school's boathouse as they prepped for the annual race against Oxford, or do they still?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I'd just arrived at King's and Down at Putney, there's about 10 boathouses, and Oxford and Cambridge boat out of, well, Cambridge come out of King's, and they had, it used to be Barclays Bank, but we bought it when I was at the school. And that was a fantastic thing. And Oxford come out of Westminster School. So two school boathouses, and these two crews use the school boathouses, and that's where they boat from on the day. Yeah, I had a series of five young Kiwis come as sort of boatmen, boatwomen. And I'll give a plug for them. I mean, the first fella that arrived was a big tall guy from Christ College, Alistair Middleton. And Alistair's a builder in Nelson. Then came Marcel Gray. He's also a big man in the supermarket chains in, I can say, in Christchurch. Tim Nelson, an accountant, arrived after that. Joanna Schotter came, and Joanna's director of Westlake Boys Rowing at the moment, so how about that? And Grant Graves was the last one, also from Auckland, and one after the other they came. I was there for 10 years, and they brought such enthusiasm and can do. If you want to sum up a Kiwi, it's all about a little bit of talking, but then a lot of doing. And that's what they brought, and they had such a positive effect and influence on the kids that they dealt with, Jim. It was unbelievable. I just love them. Isn't it amazing that making friendships and traveling is if you it always comes back and gives you a pat on the back later.
Gee, you are such an example of the good that sport does, because it's been so influential in your life. It's also helped keep you really closely in touch with New Zealand, hasn't it? What do rowers have as well as muscles?
I'll tell you what you've got to have, and here's a story for you, Jim. I said this to the guys when I got out there a couple of years ago, but that particular crew, you had guys that had real sort of a sense of rhythm and feel, and how you often get that is to row with your eyes closed. So you can't see, but you can feel, and you can hear what's going on. And I remember one outing we had in particular about 12 weeks before the World Champs. And we were coming down Karapiro about a, 16, 18 kilometers. And the coach, it was the toughest time, in the training period. And the coach, he wanted a change and he wanted a momentum shift. There you go. So he wanted us to go up a gear or two and just start to become a bit quicker. So he said, we're going to row with our eyes closed for about 10K. And so we did. And then as we were going, and you really have to feel what you're doing. So as the boat started to pick up, I mean, I'm talking about centimeter by centimeter. And there were a few whoops and hollers in the crew because you could feel it. And we all had our eyes closed. And it just started to really, and when it, and if you sit in the bow seat of an eight, you can hear it hiss and sing underneath you. And that day, when we finished that, those kilometers with our eyes closed, we were just sort of awestruck because we just sat there after it, and because we knew it was pretty special. But why it was special was because the momentum shift that meant after that day, every single day we went out, we could reproduce that feel. So we'd stepped up a gear, so I'm going on a bit, Jim, but I mean that was how significant those moments are. And then, if you've got the right mentality that you can approach a big event and just sort of perform. But that happened. So I said to the guys, well, do you remember? And they all remember the row. And I said, well, that's when we won the gold medal that day because we could reproduce the field. So yeah, row with your eyes closed, Jim. That's the secret.
Good story, Tony. I'm trying to. No, that's a great story. So, Kingston upon Thames, a nice place to live. Good shopping. I was seeing online. It's basically a pleasant village, with access to that big park and, as you said, the palace, and not far out of London. But it would have a different feel from London. A different feel
It's
from the
got,
busyness, I mean.
yeah, Yeah, no, definitely got a different feel from the busyness of London. Although, in the 30-odd years I've been here, the number of flats, accommodation that's been built is just incredible. So it's getting busier and busier, the further out from the centre you go. So even Kingston now has lost that sort of community, sort of villagey feel that was here. 30-odd years ago, it is different. It feels different now, Jim, and
Okay.
that's why we're considering options. Yeah.
I think some of New Zealand's social problems are writ larger in the UK and larger still in the US, maybe Europe as well now. No shortage of discord. Is that part of the reason for your considering your future options?
How do I express this? I mean, it's really feels a bit chaotic at the moment that people haven't got the strength of their convictions and can really be a leader, and people are jumping around trying to please everybody, and you could say that pulling out of Brexit was a disaster. To leave Europe and all those trade and scientific and all those relationships that have been built up over all those years, and then just to walk away from it, and that really hit the UK hard, I tell you. And if you try travel to Europe now, you try and take something, and the amount of paperwork you've got to fill in and all that, and the costs, and that was such a costly transition to leave Brexit, unbelievable. So yeah, I thought there's problems everywhere in the world, certainly, and London's got its fair share. But you get a feeling here that's not as safe as it used to be. There's a, and I know they are worried. There's quite, I mean, they're bringing in new laws on a redefinition of what extremism and who they're going to deal with and what they, the groups that they need to watch. And there is a sense that it's not as safe as it used to be. And I think that's a worldwide thing too. I mean, striking.
Yeah, I
Yeah,
think it's a
so.
worldwide thing too.
Yeah.
Tony Brook calling home from Kingston upon Thames. And the upon word is important because, as you say, you're not far from the legendary river. You swim in the Thames, don't you? It's that clean now.
Is. It has cleaned up, Jim. I'm not sure if you like cold water treatment, but if you got here, you'd have to join me. And yeah, no. Sometimes I swim in the Thames. I'll row on it. I'll swim in it. Or I'll sort of run beside it. But it is a lot cleaner. Yeah, no, definitely it is. Yeah.
Such history upon that river.
Oh,
It's,
yeah.
it seems like a bit of a fatuous question, but do you sense it? You know, is history in the air because of where you live?
Oh, you do. Oh, no question about it. I mean, each year there's a great river race, and the number of craft that come down that river, it's an annual event. And the big thing about, the Queen's Jubilee, a few years back, I mean, that was unbelievable. You do, you get a real sense of the Thames and it's and what it means to the UK, and all these boats and occupations of, in its heyday, what people used to do on the Thames to make a living, unloading all the boats and everything. So you still get a feel of that if you're on the river. Yeah, definitely.
What sort of New Zealand, you know, you're obviously tossing up about your future. If a lot of it, or even all of it, was to be spent in New Zealand, what sort of a New Zealand do you want to come back to? What sorts of experiences do you miss most, think about most? Where would you live?
There's a lot of good places I could live. Yeah, there's no shortage of good places. I know New Zealand's not perfect, and I'm not looking at it through rose-tinted. And I know that if I got back there'd be things I wouldn't be happy about. But I tell you what, the thing, I've got this good mate called Pete Mills, and he's got a batch in Aupituri and Coromandel, and he lets me use that every time I come out. So, and I took my son and daughter in there. And we would go in there and we'd get up in the morning, watch the sun come up, and then we'd come back up and we'd try and identify some of the native birds. But then we'd cook a little bit of breakfast and we'd just sit back with the sun coming up and listen to the dawn chorus. And if you, I mean, the dawn chorus, you'll never hear anything like that anywhere else in the world. And if you listen to the bellbird, and Captain Cook said, about that bird that it was like church bells most exquisitely tuned. And can you, the sound is unbelievable. So if I listen to the bellbird and feel the sun come up and the heat and the air, then I know I'm in New Zealand. So that's what I miss the most. And obviously really good friends. I've got some really lovely friends and family, but yeah, the sound of the bellbird, that when I hear that, I know I'm back in New Zealand. Yeah.
It may call you home.
Yeah, no, I think, yeah.
Very nice to talk with you, Tony.
Oh, so
your life is, again, interestingly poised. But what a great life it's turned into, just hearing about it today.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you often think, don't you, what would have been like if we hadn't come over here and what have you. But I feel really richer for it all. Yeah, definitely. A lot of good people I've met, a lot of good experiences. And more to come, Jim, for sure. Yeah,
more to come. And well done on pulling New Zealanders into that environment of yours so fulfillingly and working hard at that over the years too. You know, you've been a patriotic Kiwi all the way, haven't you?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, yeah, you can't take New Zealand out of me. No, it's way too deep. Yeah. So I might go back to Dunedin, actually, if I come back, and I think I'd probably get tied up with Otago University and helping a good man down there, Glenn Sinclair, who coaches all the Otago University students.
Oh, yeah.
And I've watched the Highlanders too, and you know, I'd support them at Forsyth Barr Stadium, you know. So, and I've got a great interest in early Maori history too, and I'd really get involved in that as well, for sure.
Bless. Good to talk with you, Tony. Thank you very much for giving us your time as well.
Well, you're welcome, Jim. You're a very kind man. Thanks very much for calling, and really enjoyed our chat. Yeah, you take care.
Tony Brook calling home.